Doom do 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 do. Hi, plant people. Welcome to episode 32 of
Bloom and Grow Radio.
Hi, plant friends. I hope you're all enjoying this hot and sweaty growing season and that your plants are blooming and growing and flowering and producing fruit the way mine are. I sure know I'm sweating in the garden this summer. It's been a hot one. If you listen to episode 20 of the podcast, you know that I experimented with growing tomatoes from seed this year for the first time, which has been so fun. And I'm so excited that these plants that I've been caring for months now, watching them grow from a little seed to a little sprout to a little seedling to a baby plant to now these big plants that are actually flowering and growing tomatoes. The whole process has been so fun and a little scary at times. I've been so nervous about not doing things right, but so excited that Craig LaHoulier, who was the tomato expert on that episode, sent me a bunch of experimental micro dwarf tomato seeds, which just means that they're smaller so you can grow them indoors. And I've been caring for them and they're amazing. The plants are all less than 2 feet tall, fully grown, which is so fun because they're so different than the ones that my mom grows on Fiala Farm, which are like 5 feet tall. But mine are yielding tomatoes just like my mom's are. So it's just been awesome. None of the tomatoes are ripe yet, but it's just been awesome watching them obviously grow from seed, but then watching these flowers turn into these little green balls that are growing pretty rapidly. And I just can't wait to watch them change color and then eat them. Hopefully Billy and I will actually get to eat the tomatoes this year as compared to last year. You'll have to listen to my last plant side chat if you didn't to know what happened to our tomato plant last year. Anyways, before we jump into the interview, I just wanted to remind you that the Garden Club is still kicking. So if you are interested in joining, head over to bloomandgrowradio.com/garden-club to learn more. And now let's just dive into the episode. I'm so excited to share this conversation with you because I just learned so much from our guest, Josh Rosen of Airplant Man. The episode is, as you can guess, all about air plants, otherwise known as Tillandsia. And I really wanted to do an episode on air plants because I feel like they're another one of these kind of Instagram famous plants like fiddleleaf figs or monsteras that so many beginner plant people get because they look cool and their kind of build is low maintenance and interesting and they're beautiful to look at. But air plants are incredibly unique and it's really important that we understand what they actually are, how they differ from our plant babies, and how to care for them. I've been personally growing my collection since the very beginnings of my journey into plant parenthood because I just thought they were so cool. I think air plants look like little aliens. I'm kind of obsessed with them. And they're so fun for styling too because you can obviously stick them anywhere because they don't need soil. But when I was starting out, I definitely lost one or two air plants because of my lack of knowledge on how to water them correctly and what light they need. So after I heard a couple of other friends go through that experience, I knew it was time to make this air plant episode happen. And when I decided that, I knew that I really wanted Josh Rosen of Airplant Man to be the guest because Josh, who's known as Airplant Man on all the interwebs, Instagram, his website, has created this company which deals specifically with air plants and all of the incredible ways that you can design and style with them. He does installations on both a large scale, which is custom air plant installations in places like Starbucks or really cool hotels, but also on a really small scale with his incredible air plant hangers and frames and vessels that he designs for our homes, which are amazing. You can check the show notes out for photos of them. But more importantly than the fact that he knows how to style with air plants, Josh just really knows his stuff. He has worked really hard to really understand what air plants are, what they need, how to use them to kind of set them up for success. And he just shares so much incredible information with us on the topic today. I know I'm going to be a really different air plant parent after talking with him. I'm so thankful for the time he gave us. And I hope that it helps you bloom and grow your air plant collections as much as they've helped mine. So enjoy the conversation. Hi, Josh. Welcome to Bloom and Grow Radio.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to have you on the show because I think there is so much to teach and educate on air plants for my personal collection. For I know it's a hot topic that's requested by listeners, so I can't believe we got the air plant man to come on the show today.
Good to be here, and I'm very excited to chat with you about this.
So let's just dive right in. I'd love to hear a little bit just about if you always have been a green thumb or if you had parents that were a green thumb, like what was your initial connection to plants and how has that kind of developed as you've gotten older?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Absolutely no one in my family has any sort of a green thumb.
Really?
And yeah, I definitely can't point to anyone that sort of inspired me within my immediate family. But I always loved nature, enjoyed hiking and being outside, and I loved collecting things, all sorts of different things, whether it was bottle caps or matchbox cars when I was a kid. And I think the first time I really started getting into plants was kind of going to the farmer's market and seeing little kind of 2-inch pots of little cacti. Mm-hmm. And getting to see all the different varieties was what really drew me in, this idea that nature kind of created these unusual variations on a theme. And as I got older, I don't think it was until college that I saw someone have some houseplants, and with my obsessive personality, that pretty quickly turned my living quarters into a jungle.
Of course.
That was in Chicago, which was a slightly more challenging growing region. But
yeah.
I actually studied philosophy as an undergraduate, so couldn't have been further from kind of the horticultural world, but ended up working at the Chicago Botanic Garden after I graduated. And really discovered a love of plants there. And while I was working there, a landscape architect visited and was doing a promotion for their book. And I saw all the people lining up to get signatures and realized there was a profession where you could sort of design outdoor spaces and be creative, but work with nature and people, and thought that's for me. And that led to graduate school in Tucson at the University of Arizona. And that's where I learned, I got my master's in landscape architecture, and then I've been practicing as a landscape architect for about the last 10, 15 years in Los Angeles. And while all that was happening, and I certainly love all types of plants, I noticed on a trip to Hawaii at a nursery, just the most unusual genus of plants, Tillandsia, commonly known as air plants. And right away, they're crazy forms. This, I think the first one I saw was a Tillandsia caput medusae, which means head of snakes, the translation from Latin. And they look just like they might get up and walk away. And there's something alien-like and charismatic. And when I learned that there were over 600 varieties and that they didn't require any soil but could grow suspended in air, I was hooked. And that obsession grew. And my first email address, I think when email first began, was Airplant Man.
Was it at AOL?
It was at Hotmail. At Hotmail.
Hotmail, even better.
Yeah. So I when many years passed, and it was actually after a landscape architecture project was complete, the owner said they were interested in a Tillandsia wall for their kitchen. And this was an idea I'd been kicking around, and finally had a client to sort of fund figuring out how it would all work. And that was our first installation. That was probably 6, 7, maybe 8 years ago. And once that was complete, I said, this is such a cool idea. It would be great to kind of share it with a wider audience. And that's how Airplant Man, the business, sort of came about. And we manufacture products here in Los Angeles to kind of display air plants, both beautifully enough to enhance their natural uniqueness and making care easy, which is a really important thing that I think we'll dive into in a bit.
Totally. I'm so excited. And we'll dive also into all the amazing containers and structures that you guys build for air plants, because they're just so freaking cool. But
thank you.
Just a couple things you said that I wanted to touch on. Number one, I did a show in Tucson last year, and Tucson was number one, very underrated city. And number two, we did a hike, Tumamoc Hill.
Yes.
And I remember, it was like the first time I'd seen cacti in real life. I just remember being so blown away by all of these cacti on these hill that were like 6, 7, 8 feet. And having never had seen them growing up on the East Coast. So you got to experience that climate in Tucson. And now you live in LA where like succulents grow like grass. I'm so jealous. I feel like there are houseplants outdoors all the time in LA.
It is.
So I'm jealous of the places that you've lived. And also, I can totally relate to, like,
seeing air plants for the first time in nature and kind of marveling. Like, I was in Florida this year and visiting my grandparents at their retirement complex, and I looked up and I noticed there were like hundreds of air plants in the trees. And I had had, at this point, I had had air plants in my apartment, in my houseplant collection, but I had never seen them like in real life doing their like epiphytic thing. And it was so cool.
It is just amazing. It's kind of, you get this moment of awe that nature is kind of, can be so creative just in terms of finding different niches and these plants figuring out how to survive in all sorts of unusual places.
It is wild. And they're such an interesting plant. Like you said, there's such a wide variety, and they really are conducive for people who live in apartments who might want to have plants but not necessarily want to have bags of soil or pots of soil Absolutely. Anywhere, because you can have, you know, living, growing things and not deal with like the mess of soil. Like my boyfriend likes to say, our apartment will never be without like specks of soil on the ground. It's part of its charm, you know. But if you're a little bit of a neat freak, I feel like air plants are a great option for plant parents who like live in cities and stuff.
Absolutely. That's one thing we talk to people a lot about, you know, whether it's anywhere in your apartment, but especially in a kitchen or a bathroom, you really want things to feel clean. And these plants are happiest with good air movement around them and no sort of stagnant, wet soil or any sort of medium. And so for bugs and cleanliness, they're really great. And I don't think they're officially hypoallergenic, but there are certainly a lot less aspects to them to cause any sort of allergies in people.
And are they non-toxic too?
I've gotten this question a lot, and I would say they're, you know, I get asked, are they edible? And I would say, I've not seen any that are poisonous, and I've had plenty of pets eat most varieties. So I would say not particularly edible, but not particularly poisonous either.
Well, because that's a real issue with houseplants and when you have babies or when you have cats or dogs. It's a huge, people bring home Diffenbachia not knowing that it can kill their cat, and then cat nibbles on it. So that's a really important thing for puppy parents too. So before we dive into air plant care, I'm so curious, is your personal plant collection like thousands of air plants? Like, what does your apartment look like or your house look like?
Well,
what's your personal collection?
I welcome anyone making a visit to the Los Angeles area to look us up. We do studio tours. And
I was just there. I should have looked you up. Oh my God.
Well, it's a wild scene, and yes, there's thousands and thousands of air plants, and we have gigantic clusters and trees and all sorts of projects, custom installations and stuff kind of being assembled and getting shipped out. And so there's always new plants arriving, and we get all our plants California nursery grown, and that's sort of an important thing for people to keep in mind, is this plant is so easily harvested that certain species, natural populations have really been decimated. And so it's important to kind of buy them from sustainably, ideally greenhouse grown sources. And the challenge there is they're very slow growing. And so that is why it's kind of taken the greenhouse world and the nursery trade a while to sort of build up the stock to be able to do that. But so we're always getting new plants in, and then we have lots and lots in stock to sort of create these installations and to ship to customers. And it's great. I will say my apartment does not have a single living plant in it.
Really?
That is a combination because the cats eat them.
Okay.
And also it's sort of when our studio is right nearby in an outdoor space. So we have more than enough plants outside if you've got the luxury. And then I kind of get to take a little break from work, which is nothing but plants when I'm inside.
Oh my God, that's so funny. And I guess because you're a landscape, so you do outdoors. What do you feel about gardeners who say, oh, I kill houseplants? Like, I feel like now I've gotten feedback from a couple of my gardener friends that they're like, yeah, I don't do houseplants. I only do outdoor plants. Like, have you come across that at all?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, It's an interesting question. I think we've all killed a few plants, whether it's inside or outside. I think it's about learning from what went wrong and improving for the next time is sort of the most important part of it. I kind of tell people a lot, If you've killed him, first step is forgive yourself. Try and learn what you did wrong, and then try again. At a certain point, you might want to try something else. But there is a learning curve to all of this, and you can't be too quick to judge yourself. As long as you're trying to learn. In terms of indoor versus outdoor plants, there's different things to consider. So I would say that the same set of skills and knowledge that applies to outdoor gardening is related but different when you're dealing with an indoor condition. And in general, an indoor environment is quite challenging, and that's why there's a much shorter list of plants that are good for indoor use. And so it's all about keeping in mind those unique cultural requirements.
Yeah, I want to do another episode like diving in on the differences, because I think it's so interesting. There are two like hypermobile, hyper engaged like groups of people, the outdoor gardeners and the indoor gardeners, and they're kind of very separate but like loving the same thing. I think it's very interesting.
I've never separated the two worlds. I mean, they are different, but there's no reason you can't do both.
Totally.
Do you have upcoming travel to a different country scheduled, or maybe you have a relative or a friend who speaks a different language that you want to connect with on a deeper level? Why not easily learn a new language with my favorite language learning tool, Rosetta Stone? I recently went to Italy and I brushed up on my Italian by using the Rosetta Stone app for like 20 minutes every morning. It was so easy to use. It was part of my morning practice. It was really fun. And let me tell you, Rosetta Stone works. It brushed me up so good. I was getting around Italy easily speaking Italian after putting those reps in. If you don't already know, Rosetta Stone is the trusted language learning tool available on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone has 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered. It makes language learning so fun, so easy, and so fast. It immerses you in the language, which is the fastest way to learn. So it's an intuitive process with no English translation, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in the language. It even coaches you on pronunciation with its true accent feature, which is like basically having a physical trainer for your accent. It's so wild. The desktop and app options make it so easy to do consistently, and it's an amazing value. Lifetime membership has all 25 languages forever for any and all trips and language needs in your entire life. So this year I brushed up on my Italian, but next year Billy and I want to go to Japan so we could learn conversational Japanese with it. That's lifetime access to 25 language courses Rosetta Stone has to offer, and right now they're offering 50% off. It's an insane steal. So don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Growing Joy with Plants listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life, plant friends. It's an insane deal. Redeem 50% off at Rosetta, R-O-S-E-T-T-A, stone.com/today.
So I just want to dive in because I feel like you are going to give us so much amazing knowledge on the topic, and I have so many questions because I myself have definitely, I think, been part of killing a couple of air plants.
Of course,
so
we've all.
I'd love to just kind of start with like an overarching, what exactly is an air plant? How did they like come to be? Kind of breaking down like what an epiphyte is, and like the basics, and then we can kind of dive into care. But I'd love to just understand what these little alien-looking like things are.
absolutely, and happy to share a lot of the information we've sort of gathered over the years. I will have to throw out the little disclaimer: I'm not a official biologist or horticulturalist. I'm a landscape architect and a Tillandsia obsessed person, but we have read quite widely as well. So I'm happy to kind of share a little background. And so Tillandsia is a genus within the Bromeliadaceae family. And so that includes a number of other genuses, but it's basically the Bromeliad family. And so that includes pineapples and all sorts of those kind of vase-shaped plants. There's kind of more xeric or drought-tolerant ones, kind of hectias and dicheas, and then there's kind of more tropical varieties as well, vrezias and others. Tillandsia is kind of one genus within that, and there are over 600 different species within it. And so it's one of the most diverse genuses in the plant world. And that's a product of the fact that they hybridize quite easily. And so you'll have two different varieties growing in the same, or two different species, I should say, growing in the same region. And occasionally they'll cross-pollinate and naturally create hybrids. That's also led the nursery trade to really create tons and tons of unusual different hybrids. And it's very interesting. You'll have one that has maybe long curly leaves and one that has short red leaves, and then you get something that's got a little bit of both, and it's really neat to see. Another thing that I've read contributed to this kind of diversity of species is that they predominantly live in South America, Mexico, and the southern U.S., kind of Florida and Texas.
Okay.
That's sort of the geographical region. They're in the New World only. And they apparently over history and time, as the climate would fluctuate, populations would be joined and then separated as sort of rainfall and other environmental conditions would change. And so you would kind of have these plants have the opportunity to evolve in isolation and then the opportunity to hybridize and then become re-isolated. And all of that sort of fostered a lot of diversity. And so that's kind of one of the reasons they're so interesting looking. They are one of the newest plant genuses to evolve. I think it's maybe 200,000 or maybe I forget the exact timeline. Maybe it was as recent as 20,000, but they are one of the newer genuses to evolve. So it's kind of I jokingly say nature's latest and greatest. And they basically are part of this larger group that's known as epiphytes. And epiphytes refer to any plant that lives not terrestrially, not growing right out of the ground. And they can live suspended in trees, attached to a rock face, growing pretty much anywhere. But they are not parasites, meaning that they do not pull their nutrients from their host support.
Okay.
So a tree covered in Tillandsia, it might sort of weigh it down a little and block some of the leaves, but it's not sucking nutrients from the tree itself. And this brings us to the most important and exciting thing about Tillandsia is they have adapted these very specialized leaves that are covered in something called trichomes that we'll talk a little bit more about.
The trichomes.
And the trichomes allow Tillandsia to absorb water directly through the leaf surface. And then just as importantly, once it's absorbed it, kind of seal the leaf back off and keep that water inside the leaves. And so, and that goes for nutrients as well. So they're really living on sort of the dust in the air and the dissolved minerals in the water and really surviving on either rain or some live in regions where they only get fog. And another aspect is there's ones adapted to the most harsh desert conditions and also ones that are adapted to very tropical rainforest conditions. So you'll see a wide range. And at a glance, the more gray-colored ones are more desert-adapted, reflecting more of that sunlight. And the ones with kind of wide, fat, green, succulent leaves are more rainforest-adapted. But to go back to the trichomes, there's wonderful pictures online and in various books. But if you take a macro photo of the leaf surface, it is just the most fascinating fascinating thing in the world. And each species has slightly different variations of how these trichomes look. But what they basically are is a cell that has wings around it. If you picture almost like a plug with a ruffled edge. And that ruffled edge, when dry, kind of sticks up above the leaf and blocks the sunlight and basically prevents water from evaporating from the leaf surface.
Holds the water in?
Well, at that point, you're protecting it from leaving is when it's dry. And so air plants will often have a gray, fuzzy appearance to them.
Right.
People might think that means that they're dead. And sometimes it does if they really are dead. But healthy ones, once dry, many of the species will have a a fuzzy appearance to them. Some, like Tillandsia tectorum, look positively like snowflakes. They're amazing, just incredibly fuzzy. And there are a few varieties that have hardly any visible fuzz. Most have some degree or another, though. And that is their kind of unique strategy for sort of surviving in the air. When it rains, however, or they get wet, the trichome will lay flat along the leaf surface and allow the water to kind of absorb into the plant, coming through the center of that sort of ruffled plug, if you will.
Can I stop you and ask you a question?
Of course. Sure.
So just from as someone who like totally doesn't get any of this, are the trichomes catching and absorbing the water and then laying on the leaf to then let the leaf like leach the water in? Or the trichomes are almost like the door that's either opening the leaf, like the door is open so the water can go in, or the door's closed so the water can't go in.
Yeah, I guess the yeah, it's both. So it's, I think the entire trichome structure sort of contains the ability to absorb the water and lay flat and then be like an opening into the leaf. And then when dry, to kind of puff up and protect the water from leaving.
Okay.
And prevent kind of desiccation and evapotranspiration through the leaf surface.
Well, and that's like pretty freaking cool.
It's amazing. And just the idea that how did nature figure this out? How much trial and error did this take?
Right.
Always blows my mind. And there is another layer to this. And again, all the science people should forgive me because I'm doing my best to convey what I've learned and read. But they do something called CAM photosynthesis. And this differs from
CAMM.
Just CAM, I believe. And what that means is your traditional schedule of oxygen and CO2 transmission from a plant is reversed. And that means that the Tillandsia kind of absorbs all the sunlight during the day, but it doesn't actually photosynthesize it until the evening when it's cooler and not sunny out. And so the kind of gas exchange of the CO2 and the oxygen doesn't occur until evening time. And the key reason for this is it's another way to conserve water. And it's much less efficient than regular photosynthesis because something is lost in kind of the chemical process being separated. Mm-hmm. But it prevents the leaf surface from having to be open during daylight hours and allowing water to escape. And so
that's very like succulent of them.
And succulents are another group that does this.
Yeah.
So, and you sacrifice your kind of vigorous growth in some instances.
Okay,
but
that's why they're so slow.
And that's one of the reasons they're so slow. And one of the reasons some of them can get basketball sized or a little bigger, but you're not going to find a Tillandsia that's the size of a redwood tree. So it's just another incredible strategy, and it's really all about how can they live without sort of that root system in the ground that can sort of pull up moisture and hold it. The Tillandsia itself, unlike a succulent, isn't storing a tremendous amount of water. The leaves are not particularly succulent. They're almost kind of more brittle feeling, commonly. And so, it's really got to be incredibly efficient in how it manages its water supply. So that's a little bit of science background. And I would really encourage your listeners to Google Tillandsia trichomes, and you'll get a visual that might help help clarify
totally.
What I'm
like,
talking about.
I'm thinking of Daryl from Houseplant Journal. He has a couple of really great time-lapse videos of the one Tillandsia that has the very visual trichomes on them.
That's very funny you should mention Daryl. We're actually, we've been Instagram friends, and we've sent him some of our product that is often displayed in his Tillandsia corner.
I think that's where I found you, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, because he totally has one of your
Yes, he has both grids. He has our vessels and our frames. Yeah,
right.
His time lapse is a wonderful way to see that change. And he does one with Tectorum, the kind of fuzziest, most visible trichome species. That's just breathtaking.
Okay, so my other question is, so you were saying that that's how they get water through the trichomes. So what about the other nutrients? Are they actually pulling it out of the air, or they're pulling it out of what the water catches in the air, and the water is like the main way to get the nutrients in there. Do you know what I mean?
I do. And well, I'll say in cultivation, there are specialized Tillandsia fertilizers, and the way they're recommended to be applied is by a diluted mixture within your watering regimen. So that's how kind of in cultivation the fertilizer is delivered. In nature, I think it's a combination of ways that they kind of capture nutrients, whether it's kind of dust particles floating in the air that land on the leaf and also dissolve nutrients in the water. One kind of interesting fact is Tillandsia do have roots, but they are solely for gripping on to whatever they're suspended from.
Are those called aerial roots?
Or no? I don't think so, because the roots don't actually do any role of nutrient absorption or water. They're just solely little grippers. And so when we get our Tillandsia from nurseries or growing them, they will often have kind of these clumping, ugly brown things coming out of the bottom that are the roots. If your Tillandsia is growing a lot of these, it's a good sign. It shows that it's happy and kind of trying to grip and stay in place. But we'll often trim them just for aesthetic reasons. And as long as you don't go too far up to the growing base of the plant, it doesn't damage them at all to remove the roots down there.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Is that, I would imagine, because Tillandsia, even there are 600 varieties, that's wild. But for the most part, there is some sort of like spiky, grippy aesthetic to them that, like, I would imagine is what can kind of allow them to grab on to these different trees or moss or like whatever they grow on, right?
Yeah, I mean, so they reproduce in a few different ways. I would say it's typically more the roots than the foliage itself that grips onto things, although our display products vary a little from that. We can talk about that later. But in terms of reproduction, they can reproduce in a few different ways. The first is traditional blooms, and many people don't realize that they all do have incredible flowers. Often when you buy them at a nursery or wherever, if they've kind of not been cared for very well, you might not recognize this, but they have beautiful blooms. The entire plant will do something called blushing, where it will, in many of the species, completely change color. So your entire plant will go from green to red. And then individual blooms come out kind of one at a time or a few at a time, but will only last a few days each. But they will open sequentially over a several week to a month period. And then the plant can turn this beautiful blushing color, particularly with bright light, kind of helps to bring that on. And after that, the bloom spike will sort of create seed pods. And often these seeds have almost like a dandelion-like quality, where they can catch the air, float away, and pretty much wherever they land, a tiny little Tillandsia will start to grow. And the ones that are in good spots will get big and be happy, and the rest won't. And so there's the traditional kind of seed dispersal method. There's also something called pupping. And what will happen is after the plant blooms, from the base of that same plant, additional plants will start to grow. And what's incredible is over time, these can form enormous clusters or clumps that can be enormous. So I've seen ones the size of a person with hundreds and hundreds of individual plants that if you wanted to, you could break up and would all grow individually, or you can just leave them as one enormous mass.
Wow.
And in those instances, they're going to be genetically identical to the parent, whereas the seed dispersed will potentially have a mixing like a traditional flower.
And with the seed dispersal, I mean, as a plant parent, can I like propagate from that seed? I would guess air plants grow so slowly, but really?
Yes, you could. You would just need a lot of patience, as you said. And so,
how long would it take?
Years.
How
do you do it? So, how you do it is in the beginning, you would gather the seed and you spread it around a very fine mesh that kind of prevents it from falling or going anywhere, but allows really good air circulation. And I've seen it done where it's a mesh or almost a nylon stocking can work, kind of pulled taut over a container with some water underneath it. So it's not in the water, but there's kind of humidity rising off of it.
Okay.
And then you combine that with kind of spraying it pretty regularly. And you kind of just have to be really patient. You have to label it carefully. Mm-hmm. Well, at least that's what the nursery growers do. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I've often when we order from nurseries or elsewhere, there'll be kind of tiny baby baby seedlings tucked into other plants. And I guess in the nursery, you know, some seed pollinated and drifted around and landed on some other plant and just started growing there. And so you'll get them. They can be the size of, the size of like a pinhead is sort of the scale you should picture.
Wow.
And within several years, they might be medium, tiny, and then eventually get to be sort of normal size. But there's quite a long lead time. I would say the benefit is people always ask me, how often do I have to prune my Tillandsia? And I say, you can leave your pruning shears at home.
Right.
That's not going to be an issue, but yeah, so it's, they are quite slow growing.
You hear that slurping, plant friends? That is me on my dregs of my daily dose of greens, courtesy of today's sponsor, Equilibria. Equilibria is a woman-owned wellness brand with unique science-backed products that help bring your mind and body back into harmony. I always have loved green juice and greens powders. Obviously, I love plants. I love growing plants. I love eating plants. Plants are good for you. And I have tried most greens powders brands on the market, honestly, at this point. I have to say, I'm really loving the Equilibria Daily Nutri-Greens. I might argue it's probably one of the best tasting greens powders I've ever had, and that says a lot because I've tried most of them. The Equilibria Daily Nutri-Greens contains an immune antioxidant and detox blend, along with prebiotics, probiotics, and over 35 fruits and veggies. There's no way I'm eating 35 fruits and vegetables throughout the day, but I love that I'm getting little doses and the micronutrients that are in each of the different veggies and fruits, right? Plus, they're certified organic, which I love. A lot of the competitors are not. I just mix one scoop of the greens powder into my water every day, and I'm shocked at how delicious this powder tastes. It's kind of like apple juice. I started back on the greens powder bandwagon because this spring, in this like season of rejuvenation, I'm kind of rejuvenating, doing an overhaul of my health. I've returned to my workout routine. I'm getting in more sleep. I've recommitted to my morning practice, and I've made this Equilibria Nutri-Greens part of that morning practice, drinking the powder in water in the morning. Plus, I love a female-founded company, right? Don't we all? If you want to try this greens powder, Equilibria is hooking you up with 15% off. Head to myeq.com and use code BLOOM for 15% off Equilibria's daily Nutri-Greens and so many other different products on their website. That's myeq.com and use code BLOOM at checkout for 15% off site-wide today. Take plant friends, there is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test, because plant friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible. So I made this cutie little plant parent personality quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about 5 key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right houseplants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results.
Okay, so I have a couple of follow-up questions about pups, but I think before we do that, let's just do like a brief overview of just like care 101. So
yes,
water,
this light. That's what I'm excited to share with your listeners, because a lot of misinformation out of there.
Gosh, I think the air plants have the most varied advice on the internet or from people.
To some credit, there is variation to a little bit of a degree based on the environment you're keeping them in. So someone in Hawaii with the windows open for someone, you know, in Sweden in winter is going to have very different care requirements. But that said, there are general rules of thumb I can share with your listeners that we'll get people on the right path. Okay,
cool. Please. Thank you.
So I will try to do the order of things that will kill your plant in terms of importance.
Amazing.
We'll start with water. And so the number one misnomer is that Tillandsia don't need water, that they just gather everything from the air. Again, if you lived in the tropical rainforest and the humidity was 100% all the time, maybe that would be true. But particularly indoors, where the air conditioning and the heaters really create a very dry air, it's very desiccating and drying to the Tillandsia. And so this is back to what we were talking about before. Interior plants is a tricky niche because unfortunately our indoor environments don't tend to be the most conducive to plant life. And a big part of that is kind of how dry it is and the lack of sort of ambient humidity. And so what I recommend is a submerging if you're indoors, or a incredibly regular drenching. And so the number one thing people do wrong is, I just need to spray this twice with my water bottle once a month and it'll be fine, or I don't need to water it at all. That is completely insufficient. It doesn't matter what the species is. Tillandsia really need kind of a good deep watering. There are a few species that are a bit of an exception that are incredibly drought tolerant, but all of these, as long as they quickly air dry totally within 4 hours, will be fine. Let me back up. What my top simple recommendation is, once a week for 6 to 10 hours, submerging the plant completely.
Oh, wow.
And so I do it a lot longer than most. You could do an hour or two, but 5 or 10 minutes is not enough. Once you start to exceed the 12 to 24 hours of length of submerging, they can start to die and fall apart and kind of suffocate. But a couple hours is great and will really fully rehydrate your plant. And so that's why a good submerging dunking, where the plant has many hours to really absorb all that water, when you remove it from the soaking container, you'll notice it's far cleaner or far better rehydrated. And the other thing is to make sure that water is clean. You don't want to use a sink or a shower if there's been lots of soaps used in there. You want kind of a clean, dedicated soaking container for them. Tap water is not ideal, but after many years of hauling around bottled water for the plants and drinking tap water for myself, I said these plants need to just tough it up. And so
that's my number one pet peeve is when my plants drink fancier water than I do.
No, I did that for many years and finally decided it was that these guys needed to tough it up. But it's the dissolved minerals, particularly calcium and other things in our water supply, can kind of clog the leaves over time, which is why whenever it rains, and it's pretty infrequent here in LA, but I immediately make sure all my plants are outside getting wet, because that rainwater is perfectly pH balanced and has some kind of less dissolved minerals in it. And so it's really, really healthy for them. The other thing to think about is chlorine. Most of our tap water is chlorinated. And so letting the water sit in an open container after you've filled it for 15 or 20 minutes allows some of the chlorine to kind of evaporate and dissolve before you put your Tillandsia in it. That said, I've put him right in, and you know, it's not the worst, but in an ideal situation, you would do that. And then the other thing is never use distilled water. So distilled water, because it has no nutrients in it, would actually suck the nutrients through osmosis out of the plant.
Interesting. And
so it's important. If you're using filtered water, it's just sort of a natural mineral water, but not distilled. And if you're using tap water, room temperature, and let it sit for 15 or 20 minutes before you put your plant in it. That said, if it's not feasible to do a soaking, you can spray the plant, but the entire plant should be dripping wet. Just a little spritz isn't enough. It should look like it's just been submerged. Mm-hmm. And you'll need to do that a lot more often. And so the frequency is the other important thing. My total average rule of thumb is once a week for the soaking. If sometimes that can be 10 days or 2 weeks, sometimes it needs to be a little less, but once a week is sort of the average. And if you're spraying, I would say several times a week would be ideal. And so, yeah, this, you know, isn't overly crazy burdensome, but it's not like a cactus or some other plant that never needs water. So it's a real misnomer that these plants do not need water. They don't need soil, but they do need water.
But they do need water.
They do need water,
like,
and you're
yeah,
like every living thing. And the submerging is going to be the best way to give it a really deep rehydration, and it'll last longer between waterings. But if you prefer to spray, you can do that. You just need to make sure it's dripping wet, and you do it more often, several times a week. And so that's a complete average rule of thumb. If you're somewhere hotter, if you're in Phoenix or somewhere and they're getting blasted, then they're going to need more. But if it's if you're in a really tropical environment, you can get away with less. And then, so that's water. The next thing that's going
to... Before we move on to that, just another person told me that it's important to let them dry upside down so the water
doesn't
go in.
Great point.
Yeah.
Great point. Yes. You got me jumping ahead. So after not watering, another way people will often kill them is not recognizing how important it is that the plant be completely dry within 4 hours of coming out of the water. Mm-hmm. So they can basically rot and fall apart and die very easily if they don't dry out. And so the turning them upside down is particularly important in the kind of more vase-shaped varieties. Xerographica and other varieties can hold a bunch of water in their kind of center cone, which is fine if you're in the desert and that evaporates pretty quickly. But indoors, that stagnant water can sit there, and all of a sudden your whole plant falls apart and dies.
Yeah, totally.
So it's very important. And often we'll say after you kind of take out your plant from its watering, you know, you could lay it on a towel, or ideally put it somewhere where there's going to be some air movement, whether it's an open window or a fan, but something that will blow air over the plant and help it dry out quickly.
Okay.
And so, yeah, this is it's both an opportunity and a challenge of these plants, but they like to get wet fairly often, and then they need to dry off quickly afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so that's a real challenge. And it's something that we've kind of designed into our products, whereby it's very easy to soak them and water them without handling them too much. That's another detail, is there's oils in our fingertips that kind of clog up the Tillandsia pores, if you will, the trichomes. And
right,
so
that makes sense.
A little bit of handling is fine. But if your watering method requires you to like touch the plant a ton every time you water it, which will hopefully be frequently, over time that will start to decrease its appearance. And so we like to create ways that you can do that watering without having to handle the plant. And we can talk more about that later. But yeah, that's just something else to keep in mind.
Okay, cool.
But, yeah.
And so now light,
next,
right?
Next is light. Yes, mm-hmm. The next thing. And so we ship these plants all over the place, and we've had them sit in a box for weeks at a time. And sometimes the box will kind of come back to us for some reason or another. And amazingly, the plant will be alive after like 3-4 weeks in a dark box. So
that's
not an ideal condition, but it's an example of how light will take longer to have an effect. Over time, insufficient light will definitely cause your plant to become leggy and die. But it's a slower killer than bad watering. Ideally, your plant will be, your Tillandsia will be within 6 feet of a window.
Okay.
and they like bright filtered light, however you want to interpret that. And that would be kind of could be full sun in the morning, more shade in the afternoon. Again, this depends if you're by the coast, it can be more forgiving. If you're inland where the sun is really, really hot, then they can burn quite easily.
And
so
your apartment, what direction your apartment window is facing as well.
Is going to be very important. Yeah. So if it's south or west, that's going to be much stronger than the north or east. And so, so that's just sort of a rule of thumb. It should definitely be getting light though. If you're putting it in, I get people telling me they want to put it in a bathroom with no windows. It's not going to work. The plants, they do photosynthesize sunlight. So they are quite adaptable to grow lights though. They don't need any special light spectrum. So any kind of grow light will work. And so we shipped to someone in the dead of winter in Sweden. And he said they had like maybe an hour of sunlight a day or something at the time. But they put up grow lights and the plants were just fine through, wow. through the dark winter. So so there's some flexibility there. But yeah, so ensuring that they're getting that light. In my growing area, we have kind of a deciduous tree that kind of gives them filtered light in the heat of summer and a little bit more sun in the winter, and they're really happy. I'll also mention I had the opportunity to take a trip recently to Oaxaca with a bunch of Tillandsia geeks, and we got to see all these different plants in habitat, and we saw them growing everywhere from in cactus thorns in the desert to in the jungle. And yeah, you really appreciate how hardy these plants can be in their natural environment when you see literally gripping to cactus thorns or an abujam tree, these Tillandsia growing. But it's got to be, the right combination of these things. So basically make sure they get some sunlight. And too much light can burn them, particularly if they're coming from a situation where they're used to it being really dark and you suddenly throw them in the blazing sun. Their leaves can burn. And since they grow so slowly, it's kind of difficult to recover. It'll take a very long time. So you want to be cautious if you suddenly increase the light a lot. But the more light they do get and are accustomed to, the more blooms you'll get, the more color you'll get, and the more vigorous growth you'll get over time. And so that's a little bit about light. And the last thing that's actually quite if you can manage it, is quite helpful, is air circulation. So we've done a number of installations in indoor locations where there's kind of minimal fresh air, and they can survive and they can live quite well over a long period of time, but it's not ideal. If you can crack a window, if you can have it be in an indoor outdoor space, or even rotate it where it spends some of its time on the patio and sometimes inside, that fresh air just really reinvigorates them and makes them happier because that's what they're sort of used to. And so that's why I would say they're definitely a plant you can grow indoors, but you have to be mindful that you're creating a more challenging condition than they would typically have in nature, just because of that stale indoor air that we all live with. So it's yet another reason to sort of crack a window if you can, at least some of the times. And one other neat thing I'll just mention regarding the air circulation thing is there's been a few scientific studies done on these plants. And one I read about, they took tissue samples from a colony of these Tillandsia growing on a chain link fence outside of Mexico City. And they basically found a level of pollutant within the leaves kind of off the charts, but the plants were still growing quite healthily. And so they're probably an interesting area of research that I'd love to sort of pursue a little bit more, is understanding how these plants can act as sort of air purifiers as well. I wouldn't want to falsely claim that they would compete with any of the broad leafy species, which really transpire a lot more and probably are a little more vigorous in their air circulation component. But Tillandsia have shown to be remarkably adept at sort of absorbing and thriving with polluted air.
They just sound like such an amazing
They really case. Are, and that's why I love them. It's just there's something really whimsical and tough. And in many ways, I think not to go off on a tangent, but a kind of metaphor for modern people and modern society, just all this incredible diversity and adaptation and sort of this ability to thrive in pretty much any niche and disconnected from the number one thing we associate plants with, which is the ground and the earth. And these plants are happiest when they're suspended in a place where they can sort of be perched and get good air circulation and water and light. And they've kind of figured out how to cut the tether to the main thing that we associated with what they are. And I just think that's a really inspiring sort of a story.
Oh my gosh, I love yeah. that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about blooms.
Yes.
Because I love air plants. I've probably mm-hmm. had 10. I think I've killed three, or three have died on me. But the other ones are doing great. But one thing that I've noticed, so number one, I've been told that once the air plant blooms, it will then die. So number one, is that true? And number two, when you're in the store, is it better to buy a plant that isn't blooming? Because now I'm kind of like, well, if the plant is in bloom when I'm buying it, does that mean it's going to have a shorter lifespan? Because the second follow-up question I have to that is, the ones that I have bought that have been in bloom, none of them have made cups. So is there a way to like force cups? And like, what am I doing wrong that none of my air plants have made
cups? It's a really good question. Yes. Mm-hmm. So many of them will, the mother plant, we call it, will, mm-hmm. it with many of the species will die, and then the pups will take its place. We'll follow up on why you're not getting any pups. That isn't mm-hmm. true in every instance, and there is a third, much rarer kind of reproduction that some of the plants do, where a new plant actually grows out of the end of the flower stalk and it forms almost a daisy chain. So you can have several mm-hmm. generations kind of all linked together. Yeah,
cool.
But that is a really good thing to keep in mind, is if you're selecting a plant in bloom, it's not going to necessarily last as long. I'm in terms of why you're not getting those pups, that's sort of an interesting question. I believe I almost always see pups form, so I'm not sure exactly what's going on there.
So interesting, because I have them under a grow light, or definitely within 5 feet of my window. I water them. I was told to water them for mm-hmm. an hour. I soak them for an hour once a week. So maybe I need to up
an hour's water. Pretty. An hour's pretty good, I'll say, but a little more won't hurt.
Yeah.
Yep.
But yeah, for some reason, for pups.
I have people love the pups for some reason, especially kids. Whenever we do talks, the kids are always obsessed with the pups. Another little detail though is when you're submerging your plant, always ensure that the bloom spike and the flowers are not underwater. So that will actually cause them to rot and fall apart. So during that.
I definitely haven't been doing that. So that might be why they're not getting pups.
That might be it. It's a good rule of thumb always when the plant is blooming to try and, maybe you put it a little shallower bowl or whatever, but try to make sure that the flower spike and the blooms in particular, especially, are out of the water. If you kind of submerge a plant that's in bud or bloom, it won't kill the plant, but it will kill the bloom spike and the flowers. That's an important thing to keep in mind. Good questions. You've definitely thought about this.
No, because I love them, but I have noticed these couple things now that I've had them for 8 months.
Well, you're doing pretty good then.
Yeah, totally. But I definitely have soaked flowers.
Yeah,
before.
It's and I will just mention in terms of lifespan, I get that question a lot: is how long will these last? And my quick answer is always: if you do everything wrong, about 6 weeks or 2 months, and if you do everything right, indefinitely. So these plants will just keep mm-hmm. growing and living and. And we've had quite a few that started as a single plant and are now kind of 8 or 10 plant clumps after a few seasons of blooming.
Wow.
And they're quite happy.
And mm-hmm. if I wanted, so when I finally do get my air plant to mm-hmm. grow a pup and it grows, what's the practice for separating the pup if I want to, or if the mother plant
sure,
dies?
Sure.
and the pup
and
is
so
alive.
You want to sort of follow the plant down to its base as close to, you kind of want to find that exact connection point between the mother plant and the pup. And you sort of wiggle your fingertips down so you kind of get right to that spot. And then you sort of start to wiggle the plant back and forth. And it should just sort of naturally separate. You might need to do a little snap at the end. But the goal is to not sort of break the kind of very key growing part of the plant is both where the leaves are emerging, but then at that base, the base of the plant, there is a kind of growing core that if you snap off or cut into can damage the plant. So if you kind of just gently pull them apart, it sort of becomes clear where they're connected. And right at that connection point is where it's best to sort of separate them. Kind of holding both the mother plant and the pup in your fingertips, kind of just gently kind of pull it back until they come apart.
And then two other questions I had. One was, I believe you mentioned fertilizer.
Yes.
Is it necessary and how? And then also, I'm wondering, I feel like the Xero Graphica is the like sexy air plant that like everybody Instagrams and they're so big and they're way more expensive than the other ones. So if you have any thoughts on specific Xero Graphica things, I'm sure that there are listeners that would
No, absolutely. Fertilizer. So there is specialized Tillandsia fertilizer. If you kind of look online, you'll see it's available. In my experience, I've had more problems than help come out of it. So certainly it's widely used and it's fine to use it if you like. You just have to very carefully follow the directions and be very cautious about over-fertilizing. You always it needs to be a very dilute mixture or you can easily burn the plant. It's, you know, as we discussed, it's not a plant sort of used to lots of nutrients coming its way. It's used to surviving on very few. And so boosting that can boost blooms and growth. But it can just as easily kill it if you do it wrong. And so after a few mishaps, I said, you know, I think I'm fine with the way it is. And so in no way is it required in my experience, but it can give it a boost if you're interested in that. I'm glad you mentioned Xero Graphica because although there are hundreds of different species, there are certain ones which have really kind of caught on. And unfortunately, Xero Graphica is one of the species I mentioned that does suffer from overcollection in the wild. And so it's become protected because people just went out and gathered them up by the bushel and shipped them out. And a lot of native populations have really been decimated, particularly of Xero Graphica. So one thing I'd say is as much as possible, try to track the source of track the source to ensure that it's sustainably grown, and that can be more or less challenging, but if you can learn what nursery is propagating them and they are widely grown in greenhouses, but it just takes a little longer, and that's another reason why the cost will go up. But they're absolutely beautiful. They're very tough in that they're desert adapted, so they can take less water, more light. And if they're in a bad situation, it takes longer for you to notice because they're so resilient. Mm-hmm. And there's something just so dramatic about them. But there are many, many other species that have a similar level of drama and look that are maybe less commonly seen on the shelves in the store, but if you kind of order from different nurseries online, you can see, less expensive, similar looking.
That's an interesting question. So for the listeners who maybe already have a Xero Graphica, or like for me who already have the five, basic air plants that I buy at the nursery, like what would your recommendations for like next level
my top five? Love, and it can be a little pricey, but I love Tillandsia chiapensis, like Chiapas, but chiapensis. And when I was on that trip, we were lucky enough to visit a canyon in Chiapas that had them growing naturally. It was just amazing to get to see on these cliff face walls. And that actually has a pinkish hue naturally all the time, not just when blooming, but is also kind of very gray and fuzzy like the Xero Graphica, a little bit smaller usually. Caput medusae that I mentioned earlier is one of my absolute favorites and one of the most tolerant of the kind of indoor environment there. They can be very drought resistant. And another thing people struggle with is it's often hard to tell to the untrained eye if your tillandsia are dry. The long kind of curly leaves, though, of the caput medusae, you can see a dramatic difference when they're dry versus when you've just watered them. So it's kind of an easier plant to gauge how dry it's becoming when it needs water. Okay. And there's a really neat variety of that, caput medusae purpurea, which has got a purplish tone to it all the time. That's quite gorgeous. Some really nice big ones. Latifolia is one of my favorites as well. It's kind of got green, spiky, large leaves. There's Junceas, which is a kind of very grassy-like look. And kind of everyone's probably most commonly seen beginner one is Ionantha. And those are kind of those cute little yes. ones. And when used in mass, they can actually be really beautiful, or even just one or two. Smaller plants, you got to be more careful about them drying out because they're sort of a smaller reservoir of water within them to hold on to. And that's why I kind of...
Yeah, you really got to be careful. Do. I mean, even sometimes I had one rot where I let it dry upside down, but I didn't let it dry long enough.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that, you know, that was one of the main things that we thought about sort of when designing our display products was all of them, the plant is displayed completely suspended in air so that there's water, there's mm-hmm. air movement on all sides when it's being displayed. And so often you'll see display techniques where it's, you know, in a shell or in some sort of a glass container or something whereby if there's water on the plant and it's pooling there, it's not going to dry. So we want to really create as right. much air circulation around that plant as possible at all times.
And I know this is yeah. a weird question, but how do you know? So I do some plant styling mm-hmm. on the side for friends. And one of my friends, I went over to her house and she was like, oh yeah, I have these air plants we could do something with. And it was a bowl of like the driest, crispiest, grayest, dead air plants right. I'd ever seen. But it kind of brought something up to me where I was like, well, are they dead? Like, should we soak them and see if they bounce back? But like, how do you know that it's actually dead? Because some of them kind of look dead just when they're dry. Do you know what I mean?
No, I do. And that is a good question. We'll get a lot of people, it's very sad. They'll say, look at my beautiful air plant collection. I'm so excited. And I don't know if I have the heart to tell them that they're all dead.
Yeah, and, totally.
I would just say, well, what one thing is often people will take the plants to the verge of death in terms of underwatering and then suddenly give them a really big soak and then the plant falls apart and mm-hmm. dies. And they think it was the watering okay. that killed it when in fact it was the long period of not watering. And so it wasn't necessarily the watering that killed it. It might have been the poor care leading up to that. But in general, even though many of them are green, there can often be like a grayish tone. Even though they are usually gray, you can see a little bit of green usually, and that can be an indicator yeah. that it's still alive. And I would say many species have somewhat pliable leaves where they'll bend a little bit. Some are normally rigid, but if the leaves have become very brittle, that's often a sign. And the number one sign is that kind of growing tip in the kind of the heart of it where the new leaves are emerging. If that turns brown mm-hmm. or leaves just start falling out from the center there, it's over.
Right. Like when they start.
Yeah, exactly. If you easily. Kind of give it a gentle tug, basically, that's kind of a good way to put it. Just a very gentle tug.
Okay.
If leaves just fall off in your hand, then the plant's already died. But if it's got resistance, it might still have a chance.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. I could just talk to you about air plants for hours.
I love it.
This is fun. So tell me, okay, so I'm so interested just to hear about like airplantman.com and the company and like all the cool things that you do with air plants and like where the inspiration came for them and what your favorite product you have is and all the crazy fun stuff.
It's been a really wild journey, and it's kind of funny. It just sort of started with this obsession, and then since then kind of the next step just keeps appearing in front of us. And so, as I said, we started maybe 6-7 years ago, and we started with the air plant frame. And these are made from powder-coated aluminum and hand-strung stainless steel cable. And so the way we arrived at that was we wanted a really clean way to suspend a number of these plants and make them easy.
Because it looks like a
correct.
Grid.
And so the grid is, mm-hmm. You know, we looked at all sorts of Well, the first thing we thought about was care and the fact that to live, these plants were going to regularly need to get wet, and we would never want someone to have to remove them each time they watered it. And we wouldn't want to design mm-hmm. something that if it got wet all the time, it would fall apart. And so by using stainless steel cable and the powder coated aluminum, we created something that was 100% waterproof and also really lightweight. And so easy to take on and off the wall or move around your home and just sort of use. And then we wanted it to read both clean and intentional. We're not trying to hide the fact that we're doing a grid. That's why we didn't want to use kind of the fishing line or any of these other ways of sort of making it appear kind of that it's floating when it mm-hmm. isn't. So we use kind of a very fine but intentional looking cable mesh. And then the reason we hand string it rather than using a welded wire mesh is it's both finer in texture, and then also gives you some ability to change the size of the openings when you're inserting the plants. So for a big plant, you can sort of push it open a little bit more. Picture like a tennis racket, that's a little bit easier to move the strings, and then kind of secure it in place. And it is secured in place using no external fasteners, just the natural shape of the leaf. And so if you slide the plant in from the front of the frame, as the rear leaves begin to kind of pop open in the back, they're all kind of growing forward. And so it'll just, it'll hook it into place. And so the only rule of thumb is you slide it in from the front and out through the back. Because if you pulled it out the front, you'd kind of rip off those bottom leaves. But it's amazingly easy to kind of get them all slid into place. Sometimes you'll trim a couple of those bottom leaves to the right length to make them easier to hook in. And then you can hold them upside down and give it a good shake and they're not going anywhere. And then the beauty of it is you either spray the frame with the plants in it, either over your sink or outside or on your wall if it's waterproof, or you can submerge the entire frame with the plants in it. And so it's actually quite fun. We've got our special dunking bins, and you just drop the frame in and plants get really wet. And you know, another fun detail I should have mentioned in the watering stage is it's really neat how the plants turn color when they get wet. You'll really see as those trichomes fall down, the vividness of the leaf really pops. And that's a good way to also tell if it's wet or dry, kind of how gray the leaf is. And the frame was sort of designed to let people kind of plant their own picture, but in a much kind of lighter, easier, like the plant is better adapted to what you're trying to do to it way than in a lot of traditional vertical gardens. We didn't want to put bags of soil up on the wall. We wanted it to be really clean and minimal. Highlight what was unique about this plant, which is that it's floating in air. And so the idea is there's a transparency there that's both good for the air circulation, but also lets you recognize that there's something really special here. And it's that look of wonder when people realize this is a living plant that defies most of the things we assume about plants. That sort of makes people take a fresh look at nature and kind of inspires that sense of wonder that's really, really fun and rewarding to see in people. And then the creative options are just so limitless. You can, because of all these different species that you can use, there's so many textures, colors, shapes, sizes, and you can create these kind of living artworks that can grow and change. And there's and that's the last thing we love is it's not like you've got this heavy soil where you're having if a plant dies, you're looking at bare soil or a plastic container. If a plant dies, you simply slide it out and you're just looking right through it at the wall. Or if you have in front of a window, you get the transparency of light and air passing through these as well. And so this kind of living screen, living wall component was really neat. And quickly after we sort of developed that, we saw that, you know, these were fun as kind of individual standalone things. It's designed in a way to be used modularly, so you can kind of combine a number of these together, and they have a very fine edge, so it starts to read as a group. And then they're so lightweight, you can suspend it just from a nail on the wall, just like a picture frame. And so it just seemed to really open up a lot of fun possibilities and may be good for the plants. We, through different hotel interactions, we had kind of requests that led us to develop another big component of our product line, which is the tabletop air plant vessel. And these have individual tillandsia that are hand wrapped in a waterproof wire, and they slide into different vessel bases that we've created out of powder coated steel, ceramics, wood. We've kind of experimented with a few different materials, but the core concept is the same, which is you have a single sculptural, beautiful plant above sort of a museum-like sculpture base. And this kind of highlights the amazing quality of each plant, whereas the kind of frame vertical garden gives you sort of this mass planting effect. These vessels are really fun. When you do kind of a group of a bunch of them, it feels like the whole alien gang is hanging out, and there's just so much personality in these little guys. And when it comes time to water it, you just slide the plant with its wire out of the vessel, submerge it, and then you can slide it back in when it's done. And so both of these watering techniques, you never touch the plant, you just touch the design technique, and then it gets great air movement kind of while it's being displayed. And we found that been really helpful. So that's really been the driving goal, is showcase what's unique about these plants, can have a clean design that's intentional but not distracting to the plant. The plant is the star. And then finally, make sure it's sustainably made locally and good for the plants themselves, making it easy to keep them alive.
That's so cool. And do you sell air plants as well, or do you?
No,
just
that's a good question. We started out with no air plants, and then pretty quickly realized how sad it would be to get a display technique with no plants. And so all our products include plants, and we offer booster kits, refreshes if it's needed. And everything comes fully planted, ready to go. And we even ship our frames now fully planted so that you open the box, hang it on the wall, and it's ready to go. We've got fun kind of monthly clubs too. If you want some new plants to arrive each month, whatever's coming into bloom at the moment.
Ooh, air plant exactly. Club. Ooh,
air plants of the month club is good. And new things are always coming into bloom. And so you can kind of rotate kind of a few new flowers, or you go to the store and you pick up a new plant, you can sort of put it in your frame. It's a great way. I had plants scattered all over my apartment, and when it came time to water, it was really challenging because you had to gather them all up, and it was kind of a pain. When they all live in one place, it's both aesthetically pretty striking and then really easy to water because you just got one thing that carries them all around.
Right, just dump
it. The custom projects has just been really fun. We get architects and designers from all over kind of come to us with different conditions and challenges and ideas, and sort of collaborating with them to create unique installations has been really rewarding. And we've gotten a chance to work with the W Hotel and the Starbucks Reserve, both in Waikiki and Palm Springs.
Yes, Starbucks.
It was wonderful.
That.
Their design team reached out to me, and we did two really unique installations with them. One in Waikiki. It was great to finally get to use my Hawaiian Tillandsia source, and we cleaned her out. And
tough life having to go to Hawaii to do airplane design.
Someone's got to do it. And Palm Springs, we did rely quite a bit on the Big Zero Graphicas because of how dry and difficult that condition is. And the challenge is always, how do you create a sustainable installation in these kind of challenging locations? Whether we've developed automatic irrigation systems, we often will either maintain these installations ourselves or find a local partner to do so. And one of our strategies for kind of larger installations at hotels are often sort of rotating. So, rather than a cut flower, which has a lifespan and dies, if every few weeks you sort of rotate two sets of plants, one that's back in the nursery kind of getting ideal light and air, and then one sort of in whatever dark, miserable location they wanted to display it in, as long as you get it out of there within a few weeks, the plant can bounce back and be healthy and not die. And so there's a nice way of sort of preserving. You're not just throwing everything out. But when we're able to design built-in irrigation, it is just amazing how much they thrive and how little care they end up needing. We've had some installations be in for a year or two with maybe one or two out of 1,000 plants needing to be swapped. And so that's really neat. And we even designed a mobile screen system, a series of these 4 8-foot tall installations on a rooftop in West Hollywood. And it had a built-in watering system, built-in lights and misters even. And so it was just, they were constantly having events up in this space. And so they were always needing to kind of set it up and take it down. And so these gigantic wheeled walled screen things were one of the more fun outlandish things we got to design. And
oh my God, that's so
It's really fun. It's you know, as a landscape architect myself, I'm very familiar with sort of the design process and all the different components that go into it. But it's actually a lot of fun to suddenly become the really specialized consultant and just sort of come in and work with people on this one component of it. So
the niche within a niche.
Just like the Talanzi, I guess we've become pretty specialized. But it's just a really fun plant in general, I would say. It has its unique care requirements, and it definitely takes some getting used to kind of appreciate all of those. Hopefully shared some tips that'll help your listeners today. But I would always just say, you know, don't be discouraged and try to learn from what might have gone wrong in the past. And don't consider these carefree, but if you do find the right care regimen or situation, they can be virtually carefree. I'll just share one little anecdote. I had some plant that I was doing everything I could to keep alive, and it died. And afterwards, I found another plant had sort of fallen behind the potting table and was like living like on the ground behind it in the dark. That one was thriving. So the plants will often almost mock you in how challenging they can be. And then at other times will be totally indestructible. So you have to sort of accept the challenge and that there will be unpredictable components, but it makes it all the more rewarding when it goes right. And
100%. And that's part of plant parenthood. That's like part of it is just experiencing and blooming and growing and learning with the plant.
It's
with
a good
yourself.
Way to put it. It's a living hobby. It's not it's never done and it's never perfect.
I love that.
But that's why it's fun.
So where can we find you? Everybody should follow Josh on Instagram because your installations and your photos of what you do with air plants is so wild. So where can we find you and all your channels?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely check us out at AirPlantMan on Instagram and Facebook and AirPlantMan.com. Very easy. So the word air, plant, and man, just as one long word. My old Hotmail address, still now officially registered trademark. And if you Google that anywhere, you can find us. And, you know, more information on sort of the brand and all our products is available on the website. And we ship all over the country and even the world. So feel free to let us know any questions. Yeah.
Thanks so much to Josh for joining us and giving us so much amazing information on air plants. I hope the conversation was as helpful for you as it was for me. And also, if you feel moved to, I would be so thankful if you could head over to iTunes and write a review for the show. I love reading all of the feedback you guys give me in the review section, and the more reviews there are, essentially, the easier it is for other plant people to find the show, and I just want to make sure these episodes reach as many people as possible so we can all enjoy our urban jungles. And while you're at it, if you think that you have a new plant friend or a friend who is interested in getting into plants but may be scared, please share the podcast with them. I created this to help enable other plant curious people fulfill their urban jungle dreams. So just keep spreading the word. You guys are amazing at getting the word out about the podcast. I'm so thankful to you all. And until next time, keep blooming and keep growing. Bloom and Grow Radio. Make new plant friends, propagate knowledge, and grow some freaking joy. That's the motto of the Growing Joy Garden Society app and platform, otherwise known as the plantiest and kindest corner of the internet. If you've been an OG listener or a longtime listener, you might also know this app and platform as the Bloom and Grow Garden Party, but with the rebrand, we've rebranded it to the Growing Joy Garden Society. No trolls allowed, kind plant friends only. And if you haven't heard about the society yet, Plant Friend, you got to join. It's my online community that you can access via iOS or Android app or on your computer that I built to connect our international community of plant friends so we can all nerd out together about plants and celebrate our passion for our beloved plant babies. We have members literally all over the world. I'm so in love with this community of sweet plant friends. I can't say enough amazing things about them. But also, there's a lot of really cool features about the app you might be interested in. There's dedicated hashtags to all sorts of different subsects of planty passions like houseplants, gardening, plant-inspired DIY projects, growing joy, plants and pets, and so many more. There's a plantrepreneur group, so if you're a planty entrepreneur and you want to connect with other planty entrepreneurs, you can join that group to connect and network. There's a plant swap section. Plus, the entire app, and this is my favorite part, is entirely searchable. So say you want to learn more about Hoya, you type the word Hoya into the search bar, and literally every post ever created about Hoya will pop up, so you can click in, see what other people have been posting about Hoya, and learn on your own and crowdsource hair information. It's so cool. But last but not least, it's an amazing way to support the show. Your monthly membership not only goes to sustaining the platform, but it also supports my team of editors, writers, and a community manager that help the world of Bloom and Grow keep growing. So come join us. All you got to do is go to jointhegardensociety.com and sign up for the community plan. Once again, you go to jointhegardensociety.com and click the community plan. Hot take, plant friends. There is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test, because plant friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible, so I made this cutie little plant parent personality quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about 5 key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right houseplants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results.